It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. From sophisticated imaging to targeted treatments, we examine nuclear medicine advancements and what it means for certain cancers. Recently published data here from the World Nuclear Association, over 20 million procedures using radiopharmaceuticals and imaging instruments are carried out each year in our country. Call in with questions about nuclear medicine, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Steve Cho is a professor and section chief of the Nuclear Medicine Section of the Department of Radiology at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Cho, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, your reaction to the National Cancer Institute, you know, with this explosion of research and clinical trials involving nuclear pharmaceuticals, why the growing interest?
Yeah, you know, this radiopharmaceutical therapies have been around for a while, you know, back even into the going back to 1930s, with iodine-131 for treating thyroid cancer. However, there's been a recent explosion in the advances in this area for neuroendocrine tumor and recently for prostate cancer, which has been very effective for treatment and causing a lot of excitement because not only can it be effective in those areas, but it promises to really make advances in other tumors as well.
And, you know, just at the start here, can you explain how does nuclear medicine differ from radiation oncology?
Yeah, radiation oncology, or what radiation oncologists typically do is provide external beam radiation. So they provide high energy radiation from outside the body, which they can contour and shield normal organs and target and intensify to tumor cells for treatment. They also do some treatments, brachytherapy, but you know, an area that's been developed is radiopharmaceutical therapy or theragnostics, which is really kind of a new term that really incorporates the term diagnosis and therapy in one term, theragnostics. And so nuclear medicine combines those areas to inject a radiopharmaceutical into your body, where it then accumulates and targets in the tumor cells and provides radiation therapy specifically at the tumor cells in this different way. Radiation oncologists can deliver this as well, and nuclear medicine physicians as well.
We saw the headline how the University of British Columbia received more than $23 million in funding to develop new radiopharmaceutical therapies. And in the announcement, it was really bold. Nuclear medicine can cure cancer, and Canadian researchers are stepping up the fight. What is your response to an announcement like that?
You know, I think that announcement really underlies the excitement in the field and really a lot of growing development, as I mentioned earlier, for treating cancer and effectively treating cancer. You know, in the cancer clinical and research field, we're very cautious about using the term cure because many times these are very difficult to control us. But I do like to say that, I think this is one step in our effort to cure cancer. I don't think we're there yet, but I do think we're these new theragnostics or radiopharmaceutical therapies is one step in getting there and really promises to provide cures in the future. Currently, these therapies really provide what we call durable remission or control the cancer and really provide prolonged survival and quality of life for our patients.
Are the types of cancers that nuclear medicine is most involved with, have those changed over the decades?
Yes. One area that really has, one treatment that really has, was a landmark that really showed the proof of concept for these therapies is a treatment called lutetium dotatate. That's kind of a mouthful, but the trade name is called Lutathera for neuroendocrine tumors. What's really interesting is with neuroendocrine tumors, it's really what we call an orphan disease. There are only a small number of patients, but they have a really strong patient advocacy group, and they really help to bring, in conjunction with the doctors and patients, these treatments, the lutetium dotatate radiopharmaceutical therapies, to patients in the United States about 5 years ago. Even though it's a small cancer disease group, it was really, really demonstrated to the field that this is a very effective, viable way of treating cancer. More recently, you know, they're for prostate cancer, which is a much larger problem in the United States, affecting many men. It's the second leading cause of cancer in men in the United States, and second leading cause of death in men in the United States. You know, there's a recent treatment called lutetium PSMA or Pluvicto, which was approved last year, and that really has demonstrated effectiveness for treatment and control for these patients, and generating a lot of excitement from patients.
We're looking into nuclear medicine with Dr. Steve Cho, professor and section chief of the nuclear medicine section of the Department of Radiology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, also director of the radiopharmaceutical production facility. Call in with your questions about nuclear medicine. What comes up for you? 800-642-1234. Dr. Cho, let's talk about these scans. Your specialty is nuclear imaging, evaluating how organs function, whereas other imaging methods assess how an organ looks. Can you tell us about PET image scans?
Yes. So PET scans, and by PET scans, there are imaging that we do for our veterinary animals and pets. But these are PET scans. It's symbol PET, meaning positron emission tomography, and it's kind of a very fancy term for really a very interesting imaging method, which is positrons, which are antimatter to electrons, actually are radioactivity that can be produced in cyclotrons. And actually there's a cyclotron in the basement of our Wisconsin Imaging Institute for Medical Research, Wimmer facility on the UW campus, and several around the state and around the country. You make these short-lived radioisotopes, which then are tagged to a target radiopharmaceutical. Then when you inject that in the body, it basically targets to a tumor, and then the positron emission actually provides some emissions, which can then very accurately image where the tumor is in your body. So it's effectively a way to image from within the radioactivity that accumulates in the tumor cells, and it's an effective way to both diagnose and stage cancer tumors.
What did PET scans replace? What do they do better than other imaging or imaging of the past?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, you know, I think there are many different imaging modalities, and I like to think of them as being complementary. You know, really, it's not one imaging that replaces another. I think sometimes they have some tasks that may be better than others, but really we think of multimodality, that there are multiple uses. We, you know, I think PET scans are kind of in the realm of what we call molecular imaging, which is, you know, you can, you know, I think whenever you have a target that targets a tumor cell, basically, you know, you can imagine any type of different targets that image different types of tumor cells. And so, you know, I think your imagination is the limit in terms of how you can develop these agents. So, you know, one agent that we use that's the workhorse for cancer imaging is FDG, or fluorodeoxyglucose. It's essentially a glucose molecule that images the glucose metabolism of the tumor cells. And so molecular imaging really images the metabolism and the molecular pathways in the body. So instead of CT or MRI, which really CT is looking at the density of soft tissue and bone in your body in very, you know, complicated and fancy ways, and MRI is looking at different kind of water density and kind of proton density in your body. Really, molecular imaging is really looking at using radioactivity, molecular pathways and metabolism, and really exploiting that for tumor. We do use it, you know, beyond the scope of this discussion, for cardiac imaging, for neuroimaging, and multiple other uses as well.
Nuclear medicine physician Steve Cho explaining developments in using radiation to provide information about the functioning of specific organs or to treat diseases like cancers. Join the conversation at any point about this area of medicine. The number to call in is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn how nuclear medicine is an area of healthcare poised for significant growth, with cancer and chronic diseases needing advanced diagnostics and targeted treatments. There's room to talk about this aspect of healthcare. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Steve Cho leads the nuclear medicine section at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Let's bring on a call. Marnie is here from North Freedom. Hi, Marnie.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just had a question. I don't know if it's the exact same kind of treatment or not, but my father was a few months ago diagnosed with bladder cancer, and the treatment that he was needing, they said that it's very hard to get, and so they only gave him half of the recommended dosage because they just couldn't get more of it. At least that's what the doctors told him. And then about 6 months, maybe less than 6 months, but anyway, the tumors came back. They're growing. He's actually having surgery for it today. But I just wondered, you know, had he had the full dosage, would that have changed things, or is that the same kind of treatment?
Marnie, thank you so much for sharing a personal story and thinking of you on this day of the surgery. Dr. Cho, what are your insights here?
Thank you for your question, Marnie, and I'm sorry to hear about your loved one there. You know, bladder cancer is not an area that currently, unfortunately, is not an area that we use radiopharmaceutical therapies or theranostics for. That may be a different type of tumor. They do use immunotherapy or other types of chemotherapy for that type of cancer. I think on a larger scope, you know, there have been shortages just that's been affecting many industries in production of some of these therapeutics, even, you know, non-radiopharmaceutical standard chemotherapy. So that may have been what's in your situation, and I hope the best for your family member there.
Along those lines, there is, you know, an element of nuclear medicine, radioisotopes that have been in a global shortage recently. How has that affected your work?
Yeah, you know, there have been shortages in radiopharmaceuticals, both for imaging and for treatment. So technetium is what we use, what we call the workhorse of our nuclear medicine imaging radiopharmaceuticals. And they're made in, you know, several reactors around the world. And when there's a limited supply of that, oftentimes when one of these reactors go offline, either for planned, you know, renovations and or if there are unplanned shortage, you know, production limitations. And so that's affected us. You know, I think some of the production that's happening with Northstar and Shine in southern Wisconsin promises to help alleviate some of that in the future. Usually, if that happens, we really work really hard with our nuclear medicine technologists and radiopharmacists to really keep track of the inventory of our radiopharmaceuticals and triage our patients. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and you're really close to this, leading the UW-Madison radiopharmaceutical production facility. Can you take us into that in the effort to produce materials for nuclear medicine? How difficult is that?
Yeah, you know, some of these areas, it really depends on the type of radiopharmaceutical. So the technetium is really made currently. The current method is through nuclear reactors, and there are several of them isolated
throughout the world that are specific for this purpose. I think there's a new technology that's being developed, at Shine Pharmaceuticals and Northstar that promises to produce technetium in a different manner and provide a more sustainable way of doing that. And so that really is an exciting possibility going forward, for this imaging modality. For radiopharmaceuticals, for Pluvicto, which is the treatment for prostate cancer, there have been production shortages that have affecting patients in terms of getting timely treatment for Pluvicto for prostate cancer. That hopefully will be alleviated soon. There's a production facility in the United States that's been produced in New Jersey that's been approved and Indianapolis by the end of the calendar year. But until then, they've been shipped to the United States from Italy, if you believe it, for these treatments.
Wow. It is really certainly this global industry effort in order to make nuclear pharmaceuticals happen.
Yes, and many of these radiopharmaceuticals, have a short half-life. The half-life for technetium really is 6 hours, and for lutetium is 6 to 7 days. So these are not are different from standard, kind of therapies that you can sort of make and have sit on a shelf for longer. So these require really short timeline logistical kind of coordination to make sure they get to the patients in a timely manner.
We go inside the world of nuclear medicine, recent advancements in this growing sector of healthcare with Dr. Steve Cho leading us here and heads up the nuclear medicine section of the Department of Radiology at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your question. Dr. Cho, patients are exposed to radioactive materials when they undergo a procedure using nuclear medicine. Should patients be concerned about the long-term risks of nuclear treatment?
Yes, I think as with any other treatments, we really educate the patients in coordination with their radiation safety officers and every institution, their specific recommendations. I think, what I caution patients is that you need to be careful and follow specific precautions, but it's not something that you need to have inordinate concern about. I think if you're following these precautions, so many of these are typical COVID precautions that you would have. We really talk about time and distance. So the radioactivities have specific clearance from the body, what we call bioclearance. So, many of them are coming out in your urine or stool. And so we really recommend safe handling and safe, good hygiene in terms of hand washing. And then just time and distance from the patient, from other loved ones for a specific period of time, depending on the radiopharmaceuticals. And so, I think if you follow those precautions, your loved ones and the people around you in the public are very safe if you follow those guidelines.
What about machine learning and artificial intelligence as it spreads through so many industries, including healthcare? Where has machine learning been most helpful in nuclear medicine?
Yes, artificial intelligence is an area of great growth that's affecting all fields, including yours and mine. And there have been a lot of efforts in the Department of Radiology, in our School of Medicine, in collaboration with the engineering school as well. So, I think what we want to do in radiology is really be at the forefront. So we know this is coming. And once we interact and really try to have best use of artificial intelligence, then we can use it effectively. So, my colleagues are currently using this to help triage images. So when they're inundated with many, many images, and there was a recent research kind of symposium with our residents who actually have led some of these efforts to try to triage which scans are the ones that they should look at first, which may have some findings. We also have other methods where analyses that would take really 30 minutes to hours to do can be done in a matter of seconds and minutes, really allowing for us to provide some of these advanced quantitative imaging methods beyond what our eyes can see in these images, to provide prognosis and risk stratified patients for personalized therapies.
Do you see this as the way of the future?
It's definitely the way of the future. You know, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen for some of these. You know, I think one thing in our field that was predicted several years ago by a famous AI scientist was that we don't need to train radiologists anymore because AI will read all the images. And, you know, that prediction has proven false because we're busier than ever. And actually, we're facing physician burnout because of the high number of scans that are being read. And I think AI can really help us, potentially, if we use it effectively, to really effectively read this and meet some of the shortages.
Dr. Cho, thank you for joining us.
Great. Thank you for having me. And thank you for this opportunity.
Dr. Steve Cho, Professor and Section Chief of Nuclear Medicine at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Cheese plants today are bigger than they've ever been, and bigger operations mean more waste products that cheesemakers need to manage, sometimes at the cost of millions of dollars. As Hope Kerwin reports, one Wisconsin researcher thinks this byproduct could do more and may even reduce society's reliance on fossil fuels.
Many of us know the nursery rhyme. Little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet, eating her curds and whey. But what is whey? Well, it's a cloudy yellowish liquid that's a byproduct of cheese making.
When you take 100 pounds of milk, you end up with about 10 pounds of cheese, and then the rest is whey.
Pete Condrup is general manager of Westby Cooperative Creamery. His plant deals with around 150,000 pounds of whey every day. He says it's always been a part of the cheese making process. As cheese plants have gotten larger, whey has become more of a problem. The largest dairy plants in the state produce several million pounds of it each day. They've invested millions of dollars to dry it down into livestock feed. That's a product they can make money from. But many plants are just breaking even, and some are even spending money to manage whey. That's where John Lucy comes in.
I'm a chemist, so I look at this as chemistry. You know, we can convert it to something else.
Lucy heads the Center for Dairy Research at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He wants to turn whey into the chemicals used to make plastics and other consumer products that are currently being derived from fossil fuels. He says the chemical building blocks made in oil refineries are holding us back from a greener future.
We've got to replace those, too, unless we want to keep using fossil fuels. So we're interested in making a whole bunch of these kind of basic chemistry kind of things.
On UW-Madison's campus, the center has its own mini cheese plant. There are stainless steel basins where scientists can experiment with small batches. And on a raised platform, large computerized vats mimic modern processing plants. Lucy says they recently purchased a bioreactor, which is a stainless steel chamber that can be used to ferment whey into different chemicals. And he says they already have many of the tools that are needed to design the process.
So a lot of the filtration, this is an evaporator right here. So you might want to evaporate out, remove water from it. All of these existing pieces we already use for the whey processing side. We could repurpose them, parts of them, for extracting valuable components.
The idea of finding profits in the waste product is nothing new for the dairy industry. Prior to the 1970s, local cheese plants spread whey on farm fields as a type of fertilizer. But consolidation and stricter environmental standards made that less feasible over time. The challenge led to the creation of ultrafiltration, a process for removing the protein from whey to be used in other products. Today, whey protein concentrate is used for protein powders and other supplements, and Lucy said it's a multi-billion dollar global market.
To me, that was kind of an inspiration of, we can see something that was at that time a waste product and say, this could be used for something. We could do something with this.
John Umhafer from the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association agrees that bio-based chemicals could be the next step forward in that evolution, especially for plants that can't afford to invest in the technology on their own and would benefit from pooling whey together at a central biorefinery.
Mostly it's an opportunity for the medium to small manufacturer, which is great news because it would be a new financial boon for both them and their dairy farms.
The new products could increase pay for dairy farmers. That would mean a lot, especially as the number of farms in Wisconsin continues to decline. Turning whey into plastics may seem futuristic, but Lucy says at its core, it's about letting nothing go to waste. He says farmers have long valued the resilience of making things themselves.
As a society, if we get back to kind of remaking all of it, not just disposing of it, I think people can get that story.
The dairy industry likely won't return to the days of small cheese plants and small amounts of whey. But Lucy says they don't have to maintain the single-use mentality that's led to large amounts of plastic and food waste. The industry can instead help build a better way. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Brewers, they're at home for another three-game series. Game one against the Kansas City Royals tomorrow at American Family Field. We check in on how the Brewers look this season amid changes to Major League Baseball. And what about those stadium renovations back and forth? Call in at any point to talk baseball. Join with your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. J.R. Radcliffe is here, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. J.R., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, let's start with the rule changes first. First year in MLB history where players are subject to this pitch clock. And, you know, pitchers now have 15 seconds to throw the ball. We're now more than a month, 6 weeks into the season. How is the pitch clock affecting the game?
We are seeing the shortest games that we've seen since 1984. They are way under 3 hours. I think the average game time across all of baseball is, last I checked a couple days ago, was 2 hours and 39 minutes, which is a far cry from where we've been the last few years. We've been well over 3 hours. So it's nice for somebody like me who has young kids and can't go to the park, or at least can't expect to see much of the game if I go to the park, because I've always sort of planned in my head, well, maybe we can make it to the sixth, or maybe we make it to the sausage race in the seventh. And now we can see almost all of the game. It's made things certainly made things easier for the people. People don't care about what the journalists think, but it is nice to know that you are not going to be committed to a 3.5-4 hour game if things get long. Even when teams score a lot of runs, the Brewers on Monday night scored 9 runs against the Dodgers. And that was still under 3 hours. All these games are under 3 hours. So it has definitely made the product better swifter for fans. And the players love it because there are a lot of games that get out of hand and they end up being 3.5-4 hours. And that hasn't been the case this year. So
do you think pitchers really love it? I do think they do.
There was an adjustment period for sure. That was all through spring training. And they're working faster than they previously had to do. And there are some quirks, some nuances, and things that we're kind of still working through. But I do think the players ultimately love the upbeat tempo of the game, the rhythm of the game. And I think it keeps them more engaged, just like it keeps fans more engaged.
I was chuckling because MLB called the rule changes making the game crisper, more engaging, more athletic, more entertaining. It sounds like you're kind of nodding your head yes to that.
Absolutely. And I tell you, I was a skeptic. I felt like it was when this was first being proposed a few years ago and implemented in the minors as far back as 2015, I thought it was kind of meddling with baseball, you know,
with like
I
didn't tradition. Understand it.
Yeah. And it's, you know, the game just does not have a clock. That's not how the game is supposed to operate. But I have to admit they understood it maybe better than I could have then, because it has really freshened things up. The action, you know, it's all the same action. It's the same outcomes. It's just we've cut down on superfluous time in between, you know, like stuff that didn't need to be there. And it's really made things a lot more fun. A lot more fun to go to a game and a lot more fun just to watch, knowing that things are going to be moving as fast as they are.
What about base sizes and what you see there in enlarging the bases?
So, yes, the bases are slightly bigger. It's fairly, I would say, imperceptible for maybe the average person. But the idea there was to encourage more base stealing. And we have seen more base stealing for sure. A lot more action on the bases. The whole point being we're going to make this game more exciting. And we're going to have people running all over the place. Speed is going to be a big deal. I would say it's probably less about the bases than it is that one of the rules of the pitch clock is pitchers are only allowed to, the word is disengagement. They're only allowed to basically step off the mound twice for an at-bat. And after that, if they do it again and they don't, it doesn't directly lead to an out, there's a penalty involved. The players are going to get to move up a base. It's going to be a balk, or it could be a ball on the batter. So players on the base paths know that pitchers are only going to throw over to first base pretty much a maximum of two times per batter. Once they've done that, now you have a lot more leeway, because if they throw over again and they don't get you out, they're going to be penalized for it. So it's a situation where that has encouraged, that's a little more nuancy, but that has encouraged a lot more base running, and we're seeing it. It's just across the board. People are stealing left and right, and it has brought speed back to baseball, basically.
What about reducing collisions and safety?
I don't think the newest batch of rules really addressed that. A few years ago, there was a move to cut down on collisions at home plate specifically.
Yeah.
Catchers are not allowed to stand in the path of the ball. That has accomplished the goal, I would say. There's still a few collisions here and there. It's just bound to happen. But I think with that new rule in place, and it has been for a few years, that has made the game quite a bit safer.
So the Brewers, for the first time, will be playing at least one series against every other team in the MLB. What's the significance of playing more teams?
I mean, it's cool for fans, because you get to see teams every year. You know, Shohei Ohtani and Mike Trout, who are two of the most exciting players in baseball, they play for the Angels in the American League. Under the old scheduling format, the Brewers would play that team once every 3 years and play that team at home once every 6 years. So there's a good chance you never see some of the best players. If they're in the American League, there's a good chance you don't see them, or you see them one time. And that's now different. They're going to play every team one series against every team, not always at home. Like, they won't play the Angels in California this year. They'll play them there next year. The Kansas City, who's coming into town, they'll play Kansas City on the road next year. But they will get to see every team in the American League once, and then every team in the National League twice, which has always been the case. And they still will see teams in their division more often than other teams, but that's cut back a little bit. It used to be that there was just a ton of games against your division,
mm-hmm.
and that's cut back. So it makes things more balanced, for one thing. You know, every team is seeing every team. Previously, that wasn't the case, so that should theoretically make things a little more even across all the teams. It also means you can't just beat up on bad teams in your division. The Brewers have had that advantage in the past, and other teams in the Central have had that advantage. And now they don't get as many games against the Reds or the Pirates. If the Pirates are struggling, they're not this year yet, but, you know, that would be a team that the Brewers have made a lot of hay against. You gotta beat some teams that you don't see every day. So I'm sure that adds some
interest,
some tactical
intrigue. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk refreshments at the game. You know, we saw this week the Brewers said they're ending beer sales after the seventh inning, and earlier this season they extended sales through the eighth inning in an effort to increase concession sales. Why revert to the old policy?
Well, I think I it was an interesting experiment, maybe from their point of view. I think. It's logical to assume that with the game being so much faster, like we talked about,
mm-hmm.
that you're just not going to have as many sales, because people aren't in the ballpark as long as they used to be. They're on average 30 minutes shorter in the ballpark. What we saw in the minor leagues is that it didn't really impact the game that much in terms of concession sales. You still had people who were in line to get their refreshments early on and maybe in the middle of the game, but then not so much late as they were kind of preparing, winding down to get, you know, to go home. You didn't have maybe that demand. And I understand why the Brewers and several other teams extended it, thinking we need to keep our beer sales. It seems like they just didn't really see enough of a difference to really keep that policy in place. It's obviously a little eye-opening if you're just concerned about, I mean, if you get a beer in the eighth, the game could be over in 10 to 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, I don't think it makes sense as a fan. And it certainly adds a little bit of a safety layer to have people continuing to drink 10 to 15 minutes before they leave. So I think it was just a situation where they weren't seeing enough of a dramatic increase to keep doing it, you know, and it has been a tradition for a long time to stop sales after the seventh inning. I think that's probably the right play safety wise. And I think it's probably a situation where they just didn't see a huge enough, you know, change in people's habits by adding that extra inning.
J.R. Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, as we look at the Brewers and what the season holds, perhaps looking at talent and the team's prospects to recapture the division title, maybe more. Join in on baseball at any point. Call in with your questions, your predictions. They're welcome as well. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get analysis on the Milwaukee Brewers season, the caliber of talent, and what we might expect at American Family Field with Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sports reporter J.R. Radcliffe here. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's talk players. This season, 2018 Most Valuable Player, Christian Yelich, batting more than 40 points below his career average. What's going on?
Oh, man, if they had the answer to that question, they would be so happy to implement whatever's going on. And obviously, for those who follow the team, this is a multi-year process for him. He has not been the same since 2019, when he was also excellent, tremendous numbers in 2019. Just has not been able to reclaim that. And I would say that this year is even a tick below what they've been able to get from Christian Yelich the last couple of years. He's just offensively anyway, he's just really struggling. And he's always had trouble sort of elevating the baseball, trouble keeping the ball off the ground. And right now it's kind of more of the same, and to an even more frustrating degree if you're a Brewers fan. The one thing you could say is that defensively he's actually improved a little bit, which I think is sort of interesting. Kind of came out of left field, I guess, pun intended, where he plays. But offensively they haven't seen it, and he's, you know, at this point he's signed to a very lengthy, lucrative contract. I know that frustrates people. It's also, you know, even if you could get the production that you've got in the last couple of years, it would be nice. So it's something that definitely weighs on a lot of Brewers fans' minds.
What do you see going on the mound? What about pitching?
Pitching is kind of built to be this team's super strength. And I would say if this team is not superb pitching, they probably are just going to be an average to slightly above average team, because the offense isn't built to be this dynamic threat. It's primarily they do enough, and then the pitching takes it from there. Right now, they haven't seen it, and part of that is injury-related. Brandon Woodruff, who's one of their best players, has been out. He made two starts this year, two excellent starts, and has a muscle injury in his shoulder that's going to keep him out until probably the All-Star break or later. So that's frustrating. Corbin Burns, who won the Cy Young a couple years ago, was excellent again last year. He's been fine, but he hasn't been special this year, and that's holding them back a little bit. Wade Miley, one of their offseason acquisitions, has actually been really, really good, really surprisingly so. He doesn't throw very hard. He's a guy who's been here before. He got roughed up a little bit yesterday, though, after a pretty promising start again. So they're just not seeing special starting pitching. Freddie Peralta's been good. I would say probably better than good. So that's encouraging. But if those guys can't become like truly elite as a unit, I think that they're probably in for a rough go. That's supposed to be the thing that separates them from other teams.
So we should really take a watch here. Gus Varland back in the bullpen Tuesday after that hand injury. That sounded really painful, getting hit by a ball going that fast.
Yeah, and then he got hit again in his minor league rehab start. It didn't set him back or anything, but the guy cannot get out of the way of line drives. It's just terrible luck. He's interesting, Gus Varland is, because he's what's called a Rule 5 pick, which is sort of this mechanism in place where, long story short, he has to stay on the team all year, even though he's probably a guy who could pitch in the minors. That's probably caliber-wise where he's at right now. But if he stays on the team all year, the Brewers can keep him beyond this year. If they send him down, they have to give him back to the Dodgers. It's a long story. But so he's kind of in this in-between phase where they need to keep him there, but he's probably still he's learning on the job, essentially. But he has a lot of promise, and I think he could be a pretty solid arm for them, if not this year, definitely in the years ahead. So they've just got to kind of play that game and keep him around. Their bullpen's been better than expected. They've had a couple good performances, but I would say it's also not elite. They've got Devin Williams, who's their closer, tremendous, you know, no notes, awesome player. It's everybody else that you probably have to worry about. Who's the reliable eighth inning guy? Who's the reliable seventh inning guy if they're winning? Mm-hmm. You know, they're still okay. They're better than anticipated in the bullpen, but I don't know if we're seeing them be, you know, anything beyond that just yet.
All right, thermometer there, Major League Baseball and the Brewers. J.R. Radcliffe, our guide, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel sports reporter. You can call in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your predictions. Let's go to Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hello. I, for one, feel that because Mr. Attanasio is a multimillionaire, he should be responsible for at least half of this magnificently costly roof repair that we're facing here in Milwaukee. And I'm also wondering if you think that a city the size of Milwaukee can enthusiastically support a minor team. I think that's the same thing as a B team. When 22 years ago, when this Miller Park was being built, I felt that should have been renovated, not torn down, and a B team brought in when the Braves decided to move. I just think cities across America are being held hostage, absolutely held hostage, by these multimillionaire team owners who make these threats to move their team if their every demand is not met.
Nancy, thank you. The renovations tug of war. Go ahead, JR.
there's a lot there. Milwaukee has a long history of supporting minor league baseball, you know, since long before the Milwaukee Braves were here. So do I think it could support a minor league team? I do. Cities that have major league teams aren't going to have a minor league team as well, just in kind of the current system. And I would say that this town has really gone to bat for the Brewers. You know, they have they're middle of the pack in attendance, even though the market is absolutely the smallest media market in baseball. So I think Major League Baseball wants to stay in business in Milwaukee as much as it possibly can because of how successful it has been drawing people. There is a lot baked into the stadium financing situation. A lot of it comes from how the contract is drawn up with the stadium district and what the stadium district is ultimately, and the stadium district is a government entity, what it's responsible for in terms of repair and renovation. There is a clause in there where if X number of stadiums have a certain amenity added to their place, then the stadium district is responsible for financing that part of it with American Family Field. So that can get very sticky and very complicated. I do think that there is a lot of consternation about owners. You know, I think the line is they're you know, making the financing public and then they're privatizing the profit, you know, that, and I understand certainly where people are coming from. Milwaukee is not unique in that sense. There are like the caller mentioned, there's a lot of situations where governments are paying hand over fist to finance these stadiums. And then the owners are the ones who ultimately benefit. So I understand the consternation for sure. I do think there are some pretty good qualities with the situation in Milwaukee, more so than other places. And, you know, I do think this is still a Major League Baseball town and is going to be for a really long time.
So really quickly here, the renovation fallout, you don't see the Brewers on the line leaving Milwaukee over this issue with renovations?
I really don't. And I know there's a lot of back and forth and plans being declared dead or whatnot. Primarily, when you get to a situation like this, you get a lot of bipartisan support. Nobody wants to be the one, the politician, who made it difficult for a pro sports team to stick around and then they leave. So eventually, you're going to get government support. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know, you know, who gets to, you know, take the photo ops. But it's really, really likely to get done because, like I
said,
we'll
be watching. JR, thanks for joining us. JR Radcliffe, sports reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.